Women in Afghanistan. Is life any better for them?
What really happens to women on the ground in Afghanistan is totally different from all this progress you keep reading about in the press.
That's journalist Ann Jones. We spend the hour with her talking about Afghani women, the war in Afghanistan, and whether life is any better for its people since the U.S. invaded their country. That's coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Many people thought that when the U.S. got involved in Afghanistan, the position of Afghani women would improve. That position is something award-winning U.S. journalist and women's rights activist Ann Jones knows a lot about. She went to Afghanistan in 2001 and worked in Kabul with war widows, trained English teachers, and investigated conditions at Kabul's prison for women. Her trenchant report, Kabul in Winter, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan, was published in 2006 when we first interviewed her. Since then, she's continued to visit and write about Afghanistan, and in particular, the position of Afghani women. I called her to get an update on Afghani women. Jones says the war and new laws put into effect by the U.S.-backed Karzai government have made things worse for most women in Afghanistan. Ann Jones decided to go to Afghanistan in the first place after George Bush responded to the 9/11 attacks by bombing that country.
And I decided that the course that the U.S. had chosen is not the one I would have chosen. So if he was going to bomb Afghanistan, I decided I had to act on my beliefs and go do something about it myself. So as soon as the bombing stopped, I went and volunteered with various small NGOs to help in the work of putting things back together again.
Now, when you went, you spent a lot of time with Afghani women, which you wrote about in your book, Kabul in Winter. You worked first in a women's prison where many of the women were in prison for having been raped. You were also retraining English teachers who had been unable to practice their profession during the Taliban rule. You've been going back now periodically since then, and you wrote an article in The Nation in November of 2009 called Remember the Women. Tell us what's been going on with Afghan women.
Well, that is very complicated. In Kabul in Winter, I wrote about the terrible traditional conditions under which women live, subject to forced marriage and various other atrocities, enormous rates of violence against women, which of course are particularly exacerbated by poverty and warfare, as we know, everywhere. And then the rules that are shaped by a misogynistic culture that discriminates so heavily against women and do result in their often being just confined in the home, sold off into marriages as children, and arrested and locked up for things like trying to run away to escape violence at home or to escape from rape. After the new Karzai government was established, that came in with some stipulations put on the arrangements by the international community, and one was that there would be a new constitution and that there would be a percentage, about 25% of the parliamentarians would be women. So on paper, since then, it looks as though Afghan women have made considerable gains. There's a clause in the Constitution which the Americans and most Westerners construe to mean that under the Constitution, men and women are equal. But Afghans themselves, fundamentalists, don't construe it that way at all. So that's still a debatable point.
Well, tell us about how that works. I mean, you say that the Paper Foundation, that equal rights have been illusory all along, a feel-good fiction. How is it that you can have a law on paper that is so flagrantly violated in practice and, in fact, has other laws that completely undo it?
It all depends on the interpretation. The Article 22 in the Constitution says that under the law, men and women have equal rights and duties. So it's easy to understand how Westerners might construe that to mean that men and women have equal rights. But in fact, if you're an Islamist fundamentalist, as are most of the people in the government we set up, as are the Taliban, as are most of the members of the Afghan judiciary, you construe that to mean that men have the rights and women have the duties. And they are very, very different things. And also, of course, in the Constitution is a key provision that no law in Afghanistan may be in contradiction to the laws of Sharia. So that in actual fact, the rights that seem to be granted to women by the Constitution and by various international treaties that Afghanistan is a signatory to don't actually exist at all. They are not, as we would call them, inalienable rights. These rights can be cast aside in a moment by anyone who is in power and chooses to interpret them in terms of fundamentalism.
Give us an example, if you may. I mean, a lot of us heard of the what became to be called the marital rape law. How does this fit into what you've just told us? And tell us what that is.
It's called the marital rape law by Western journalists. It's the personal status law, the Shia personal status law, that is was passed ostensibly by the parliament, but with some very odd procedures, sort of circumventing any real discussion. And it passed through committees that were staffed entirely by Islamist fundamentalists, that who are, of course, the predominant powers in the parliament. And this law enacted a set of rules for family status and family relations in the Sharia population, in the Shia population, which is a minority in Afghanistan. And it is the minority, actually, the Hazara minority, that traditionally has had the freest regulations for women. And in fact, most of the women who have risen to prominence in Afghanistan have been Shia women because they are better educated, they do have more opportunities. This law turned that all around and made them subject to traditional laws that would have been imposed under the rules of Sharia. In fact, the law was originally drawn up in Iran and came via ultra-conservative ayatollahs and mullahs to be proposed in Afghanistan. There was a good deal of international protest when it came to light because the law does contain such provisions as the one the Western press focused on. That is, if a woman denies her husband his sexual rights, he has the right to withhold food and sustenance from her. In other words, he can starve her to death if she doesn't give him sex, the law says, once every 4 days. And that is based on the assumption that a man has four wives, so she has to do her turn. The Western press raised a lot of fuss about this, as did Afghan feminists and Afghan women activists and some of the women parliamentarians. And there was even a demonstration in the streets of women, about 300 or 500 women in Afghanistan, which is an enormously rare and brave, courageous act. So Karzai said that this would be taken under review, and he made a promise to a group, a delegation of women who conferred with him, that it would be amended and then brought to the parliament again. Instead, Karzai put it into law in a very slightly amended version just before the last elections. And it was clear to observers there, I was there at the time also, that he slipped it in then because the United States was so concerned and the international community in general so concerned about the upcoming election that they wouldn't get on his case again about this. And that's exactly what happened.
And this is the Obama administration we're talking about.
Yes. And they never said a word about it. So it became law. And the assumption has been, even among women in parliament, that this law only will apply to Shia. But, you know, when they come for one, they come for the next soon after. And indeed, a similar bill is already introduced and going through parliament to apply to Sunni women. And so the parliament is actively engaged and the president is actively engaged in putting into effect laws that are in direct violation to the Constitution and the international treaties that everybody in the international community is so proud of. What really happens to women on the ground in Afghanistan is totally different from all this progress you keep reading about in the press.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Ann Jones about women in Afghanistan. Her memoir, Kabul in Winter, was published in 2006. We're getting an update about the impact of the war on Afghani women since she wrote that book. And, you know, as you have written very passionately, both in your book, Kabul in Winter, as well as in your article since then, it's not exactly as if women's position right now is all that much freer than the laws that are now going into effect. You have some shocking statistics. 80% of women are beaten at home on a regular basis. Rape is an everyday occurrence. Rape within the family, children being married off, as you said before. Tell us, has the situation just stayed the same, or has it actually gotten worse?
Both. Both is the short answer to that. The situation has gotten better for women in Kabul and to a certain extent in probably Herat, maybe another, or maybe Mazar, a couple of the other major cities. It has gotten better for those women who are educated, who were already educated, who have been able to get jobs with NGOs or go into the parliament, and who have become active. There is very active movement in Kabul of women who have formed all sorts of organizations to campaign for women's rights and to give real assistance to Afghan women and girls. And of course, in Kabul and in the other cities, girls are in school these days to a much greater extent than they were under the Taliban. But throughout the countryside, and you have to remember that a good 80%, maybe 85% of the population of Afghanistan is a population of subsistence farmers living in the countryside. And in those places, the life of women have changed very, very little. One thing has made them slightly better, and that is where poppy is grown, women are often employed in the poppy fields. And that's not only a relatively high-paying job for a woman, but her bringing some money home enables her kids to stop working and to be able to go to school. So that has made life a little better. But as you remember, we're trying to put a stop to that part of it. And then the thing that has made life worse for so many women in the countryside is the ongoing warfare, because civilians are always getting caught in the middle of the, especially the American forces, the NATO forces on the one hand and Taliban on the other. So we know that hundreds, thousands of civilians are killed. Thousands have been killed by American airstrikes in the past, although General McChrystal has recently tried to reduce those airstrikes with a little bit of success. But as bad as that is the displacement that these civilian populations undergo. And you meet in Afghanistan camps of displaced people who've been displaced from the north to the south, and then from one part of the south to another part of the south. And so people have been on the move, displaced time after time after time. And it's a terrible situation for those women and men, civilian men and their children, who are forced out by war.
Now, you've gone through a kind of evolution, it sounds, yourself, at least from what I've some of your pieces that you've written. You have had the position, you followed what you call the conventional wisdom that holds that without security, i.e. without U.S. troops on the ground and the other so-called coalition troops and the contractors, that development can't take place. And now you're voicing a somewhat different perspective. So how does this whole issue of security, development, protection of the rights of women, and war, how should we think about this?
Well, you're right that my ideas have changed over the years. And part of that has to do with the fact that we didn't seize the moment in time just after the invasion to really focus on Afghanistan and development in Afghanistan, because at that time the Taliban had disappeared or blended back into the civilian population, and it was possible to travel anywhere in the country and to work anywhere in the country, and enormous amount of development could have been accomplished at that time. But as everybody knows, that is not the course that the U.S. chose to take. And it was because we left the countryside to lawlessness that the Taliban came back, the warlords exerted their authority, and law and order sort of disappeared. And that's what made it difficult to work in the countryside. And that situation has grown increasingly worse since the United States and NATO went into action in the countryside. In other words, our military activities have made that situation much worse. So while before I thought we needed security in order to work on development, and I still believe that, the presence of our troops does not bring security. It brings just the opposite. It brings more and more violence. So we're now in a paradoxical situation, and I really don't know how we get out of this one. But I think the only answer is negotiation. The military activity, as many, many military and retired military people have said themselves, is counterproductive. We're only creating more enemies the more we fight. And the sooner we get to some kind of negotiating table, the better it's going to be.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, you have said that, you know, there's actually very little difference between the Mujahideen, the warlords, and the Taliban, at least in terms of the way they treat women. And so if we're going to negotiate, who are we negotiating with, and what should be the stance, and where do we place women within this?
Well, we would be negotiating with the Taliban, as Kai Ida of the UN was doing for the past many months, until Pakistan and the U.S. jumped in and arrested the very people he was negotiating with and put a stop to the talks. We would negotiate with the Taliban because the Taliban should have been negotiated with after 9/11 at the Bonn Conference. You know, you end a war by having a peace conference, by bringing all parties to the table and settling things. We didn't bring all parties to the table. We only brought our old warlord guys that we wanted to put in power, and that's what we did. So no peace process has ever taken place in Afghanistan since 9/11, and that's what has to be negotiated. Now, many, many women, Afghan women, in Kabul and other cities are dreadfully afraid of what would happen if peace negotiations take place, because of course they are understandably fearful of falling under the control of the Taliban again. But they're already under the control of a government that is not that much different from the Taliban, and probably would be even more like the Taliban the minute the international community left town. So in a way, it's a false hope to think that if you exclude the Taliban, women are going to be all right. Women are not all right. And how we make them all right within that context is what would have to be negotiated. And I have good friends among Pashtun women activists who believe that the Taliban will not behave as they did before.
Why do you think that? Why do they think that?
They believe that what the Taliban want is just to be able to be part of their country again, have a voice in their country again, have a voice in the administration of it again. But they did not want to be overthrown. They didn't want their country to be bombed. So Pashtun women leaders believe that the Taliban would behave differently this time in order to avoid that kind of retaliation again or reaction from the international community, and particularly from the United States. They'd behave better because they don't want to be in so much trouble again.
We're talking with journalist Ann Jones. She says the position of most women in Afghanistan, brutal under the Taliban, has actually gotten worse since the Taliban were overthrown. Partly that's because of the impact of the war, and partly because the U.S.-backed Karzai government has instituted policies that undermine women's basic civil and human rights. It seems so tragic, really, that we're talking about negotiating with people who are brutal, no matter how you look at it in terms of how they do treat women.
It is terrible. It is terrible. And I'm not making any defense for the Taliban, and I am not persuaded by the opinion of my Pashtun women activist friends, but I repeat it because they know more about their culture than I do. But we have to remember that here we are fighting on the side of a president who not only stole the last election and is regarded as entirely illegitimate by most Afghans, but who has kept his own wife confined at home during the whole time of his presidency.
Yeah, and talk about that. She's a doctor.
She's a gynecologist, yes. Her skills are very much needed, but she's never in public. She is confined at home. He's as much of a Taliban as the Taliban in that regard. In other words, those attitudes, those misogynistic attitudes, are not confined to the Taliban by any means. You can look at Abdul Rasul Sayaf, who is the most powerful member of parliament, a former warlord, a good friend of Mullah Omar and Osama bin Laden. Many say he's the guy who invited Osama bin Laden back to Afghanistan. During the Civil War, his troops, his militia, became notorious for not only raping and murdering women on a wholesale basis in Kabul, but for scalping them. And he is now the most powerful man in parliament. And the 25% of women are sitting in parliament, I would say most of them, terrified of this man and very much afraid to speak up for women's rights because he will accuse them of blasphemy. And blasphemy is a crime punishable by death. And he has made those accusations against many women. The women in Afghanistan who are standing up for their rights in the face of all this are brave beyond belief. They are enormously courageous. Most of us would not have that kind of strength, and a great many of the women in parliament and other would-be leaders can't find it within themselves either to take that kind of risk. A number of women leaders have been assassinated.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, you go down the list, an incredible list of women who've been assassinated. Just tell us the stories of just a few of them.
One who is particularly well known was a woman police officer in Kandahar. Kandahar has been under the control of the central government, the Karzai government, all along, but it's had its opponents, certainly. And she headed a division of women police officers in the Kandahar Police Department that was charged with investigating and taking action in cases of domestic violence. And she was much beloved and very effective. She was the mother of, I think, five or six kids, and she was assassinated. Her deputy, also a woman, has to, you know, put on her armored vest and go back to work after that. And there have been many others, some of them quite old women who were campaigning for women's rights, who were working on behalf of women's health, who were working on getting girls into school, and they're shot down.
Yeah. If you could, tomorrow, tell Obama what you feel really needs to be done here. And I know this is probably not a fair question, but what is going to get Afghan women the rights that they need in order to help develop their own country as well as be able to live their lives in the best way in the long term? I realize we can't order this up on the plate tomorrow.
Yeah, we're talking about some cultural traditions that are really, by our standards, pretty primitive in many parts of the country, but it's possible to work with people because a lot of those traditions come out of isolation, poverty, lack of education, and for a long time, even through the years of the proxy war against the Soviets, even during the Taliban rule, international NGOs, particularly European ones, and I would cite with great distinction the Scandinavian NGOs, the Irish, and the Dutch, have been working on a small scale steadily all that time and making changes to just gradually improve the lot, not just of women, but of all people, of the whole community. And also in Afghanistan, there is under one of the ministries a national solidarity program that works in villages and has made great progress in getting the women to participate in the life of the community and establishing projects that move the community slowly, slowly ahead with health or education or other community projects. But all of these programs that have gradually over the years made progress are non-governmental organizations devoted to that humanitarian progressive development. And the conclusion I've come to is that you simply do not make peace by making war. So the sooner we can get our troops out of there while trying to make some transition to protect not just women but whole communities, the better. And the sooner we can work to integrate the Taliban back into the community instead of creating more and more Taliban as we go along, the better it will be. That's the only way I see to proceed. I don't know that it will be a success, but I do know that what we're doing is bound to fail.
Well, Ann Jones, thanks so much for giving us this update. It is a terrible situation that you're describing there, but I am so glad that you are telling us what's really going on.
Thanks so much, Francesca.
Journalist Ann Jones. After the break, we'll hear our 2006 interview with her about her book, Kabul in Winter. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In the first half of our show today, we spoke with Anne Jones about the current situation facing Afghani women. Back in 2006, we spoke to her about her book, Kabul in Winter, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan. Impressively researched, it's also a powerful personal take on what she found.
I found, of course, a completely devastated city in Kabul. Two-thirds of the city in total ruin, people living in tents in the dead of winter, food shortages, no electricity, no potable water. And I found people really traumatized after so many years of war. The country had been at war for 24 years, and the American bombings had killed thousands of civilians in Kabul. So everyone was very deeply traumatized, destitute. Everyone had lost friends and family members, and everyone was scrambling just to survive at that point.
You made a connection to a group called Madar. Could you say something about that?
Yes, I had made a connection on the internet with that group before I left. It was founded by an American woman who had lived in Kabul in Afghanistan since the 1960s, most of the time, and had been in Peshawar during the time of the Taliban, but then came back and started a charitable organization to try to help the widows of the country who had suffered so much during the wars and then, of course, under the Taliban. And she had a group of Afghan women assisting her. And I thought, if anybody knows how to help the Afghans, it has to be somebody who's been there for a long time. So I offered myself as a volunteer and began to assist her and then found my own work after that.
She loved Afghanistan, and she remembered it as a very different place. What was Afghanistan like before these 24 years of war?
Well, in the time of King Zahir Shah, which is a time that most Afghans who are old enough look back to with great nostalgia, it was actually a fairly progressive place, and it was moving into the modern world. Women dressed in the capital, in any case, in Western clothes. Girls were wearing mini skirts on the campus of the university in the 60s. Women were career women. They were a high percentage of the country's doctors, teachers, lawyers, professional civil servants. And there was a great degree of freedom. It was, of course, an Islamic country, but it was never a fundamentalist Islamic country. The Afghans tended to practice Sufi Islam much more than the fundamentalist schools that have become more familiar to us now. Sufi is a much more mystical and personal form of religion and spiritual life, and it makes for much greater tolerance. So it was quite a nice place, I think, to live. I met many women in the classes I began to teach who in those days had owned their own cars, driven their own cars around Kabul, traveled to Europe on vacation. And these were school teachers. They were not the elite, though they certainly were members of an educated class. So I think it was a pretty nice place at that time.
Even back in 2006, Anne Jones said that in spite of a pouring in of foreign aid, the condition of Afghans in the countryside, the vast majority of the population, saw no improvement.
most of the changes that have taken place in Afghanistan have taken place in Kabul and a couple of the other larger cities. But for most Afghans, nothing has changed. Nothing. The people in the countryside still live the same way they did before. And although billions of dollars of aid supposedly have entered the country, and one can meet in Kabul any number of people who will tell you that they are busy building schools and clinics all over the country, when you actually go to those provinces and ask the people, they say, no, nothing has been done for us. We don't have schools. We don't have clinics. Now, in Kabul, the picture is different in that many women and men have gone to work for all the international organizations that are there supposedly administering aid or assisting the government. So for those people who have hooked up with the international community and are making, for Afghans, a very good wage, certainly times have gotten better. One also sees in Kabul tremendous amount of new construction of glass office buildings and very large palatial houses in the style of the Gulf states. They're called Pakistani palaces because they're quite elaborate. It's like Mount Vernon covered with bathroom tiles in bright colors. But it's hard to distinguish how much of that comes from foreign aid and how much of it comes from the drug trade. And Afghans believe that most of that the new riches that are on display in Kabul are from the drug trade. And those riches by no means reach down to the average citizen. So what we're seeing developing in Kabul and a couple of the other major cities is an enormous widening gap between the super rich, the drug barons, and the poor, who are just as destitute as they ever were.
So it's kind of a narco state.
Yes.
I believe Afghanistan, you say it provides 89% of the world supply of heroin, is that correct?
It's a figure right up around there. They, you know, different people give different statistics, but the major share of the world's heroin. And it's important to realize that before the involvement of the United States and the CIA in that part of the world, this was not the case. As we've seen in previous wars in Vietnam, in Laos, and so on, the boom in the drug trade tends to follow CIA involvement in an area. And that's what's happened in this part of the world.
In her book, Kabul in Winter, Ann Jones writes about the warlord Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who's recently been in the news. The leader of Afghanistan's second-largest insurgent group after the Taliban, Hekmatyar has sent a delegation to Kabul to negotiate a peace deal with the Karzai government and coalition forces. Hekmatyar is blacklisted by the United Nations as an international terrorist. There's one particularly unsavory character who appears again and again in the book, and that's Gulbuddin.
Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, yeah. Gulbuddin was one of the leaders, a leader of one of the seven major factions of the Mujahideen, or that is the fighters who fought against the Soviet occupation. And the important thing to know about him and the members of the leaders of the other Mujahideen parties is that they were all Islamic extremists and fundamentalists.
From the get-go. Describe a little bit about what that meant in reality. What type of a guy was he and what did he do?
Well, Gulbuddin was is often called by people who know him, he's still around, a psychopath. And he gave evidence of that from the time he was a student at Kabul University. That was in the times I've described as the good times. And Gulbuddin amused himself by throwing acid in the faces and at the legs of girls who were students on the campus going about in Western dress with their faces unveiled and wearing short skirts. He attacked them, beat them up. He was charged with murdering a fellow student. He was an unsavory character from the beginning, yet he was the one to whom the United States gave the lion's share of the aid. But of course, that was a decision really made in Pakistan, because the U.S. kind of turned its operation over to the Pakistani ISI, intelligence service, and they directed where the money would go. And the money went to the Islamic extremists of their preference, and that was largely Gulbuddin.
So why were they interested in this? Why were the Pakistani supporting this? And why was the U.S. supporting Pakistan?
It's in Pakistan's interest, of course, as a neighboring country, to control what goes on in Afghanistan. So they wanted to establish their own puppet. The extreme Islamic fundamentalists held a great deal of power in Pakistan, and they wanted their own kind and their own puppet ruling in Afghanistan. The U.S., of course, wanted the Soviets out.
Well, it sounds like there was a kind of intersection of interest, too, because you talk about, although Afghanistan itself is not particularly oil-rich, there's this question of the oil pipeline between oil-rich regions of the former Soviet Union on the border of Afghanistan and then kind of getting it out to the Western world. So there's that as well as that kind of realpolitik of
There is that, and of course they needed Afghanistan to circumvent Iran, which was on our list of bad guys at that time. They also needed Afghanistan strategically, and that is still the case. It's one of the things that makes it very difficult now to distinguish between what are the unintended consequences of American intervention and what are the secret consequences, the desired consequences of American intervention. And there are those who would argue that what America really wants is not a complete stabilization of the area, but rather enough destabilization so that we can maintain our presence there because we need military bases in that country, particularly after we've been kicked out of our military bases in the other countries of Central Asia. So the U.S. needs those bases, the U.S. wants the pipeline, and there is every likelihood of discovering oil in Afghanistan. All the earmarks are there, the geological earmarks. So for military and industrial reasons, corporate reasons, the U.S. has quite, I think, achieved pretty much what it wants.
Well, that's interesting because I remember after 9/11, the idea was that the U.S. went to bomb in Afghanistan in order to get the Taliban out, and that really Afghanistan was not the real objective. The real objective was Iraq.
Most of the commentators who have looked closely at the foreign policy of this administration right after 9/11 say that from the very beginning, the administration was talking about rolling out its plans for the invasion of Iraq. And despite the fact that Afghanistan had been the host to Osama bin Laden for years, there was no plan on the shelf for what to do if something bad happened in Afghanistan. So I think that the administration wanted to go directly to Iraq, but since, unfortunately, the attack had come from Afghanistan and not from Iraq, they were stuck with the job of doing something in Afghanistan first. But what they did was some high-altitude bombing that killed a whole lot of civilians, and they put very few people on the ground. They paid the old Mujahideen about $70 million to go after Osama bin Laden, who, of course, was one of them. So this was a misguided plan that was doomed to failure from the start and probably reflects a certain lack of serious interest on the part of the administration, because within months or even weeks of going into Afghanistan, they were actually withdrawing the forces from there and moving them into position to invade Iraq.
So the impact of this, you say it killed a lot of civilians, but you paint a more complex picture, I think, than just the one of kind of the misguided and exploitative policy of the United States, but also to look at the issues and problems within Afghanistan itself. You're pretty unsparing both of, in other words, of Afghan society as well as these powerful foreign interests. So I wonder if you could talk about a little bit of that and how did you reconcile, you know, what you loved about Afghanistan, what you hated about Afghanistan?
Well, the Afghans themselves, of course, are a tribal culture, and the dominant tribe is the Pashtuns, who are notorious in world history for being able to kick out intruders, most notably the British. They've visited upon the British the worst military defeats in British history. They have a very strong reputation as great fighters and tend to fight with each other when they have nothing else to do.
Yeah, you went to a pretty remarkable game.
Oh, the Buzkashi game, yeah.
And you say that Buzkashi is a metaphor for Afghanistan. Talk about that.
Well, I think it is. It's a Central Asian game originally played on horseback. Used to be played with a human head. Now it's played with a dead calf. It's men on horseback struggling for possession of a dead calf. And the object of the game is to reach down and pick this calf up off the ground and race away with it until you are completely free of all the other riders, and then you drop it on the ground again. And that's considered a victory. You've won that inning. Well, when you figure that a dead calf weighs close to 80 to 100 pounds, and these guys are running around on semi-wild galloping horses, slashing each other with their whips, it's quite a spectacle. And it's an entirely individualistic game. It is truly every man for himself.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Ann Jones about her book, Kabul in Winter. So can you make a connection between this and what you call, and seems pretty clearly, the patriarchal nature of Afghan society? I guess what I'm trying to kind of angle into here is how this relates to the treatment of women.
Well, we're dealing here, of course, with a patriarchy, and it's a particularly threatening kind of patriarchy, I think, because you do have this ethos of every man for himself. So every man is just kind of hanging on by his fingernails, you know, and that inspires a kind of grasping of one's own possessions, I think. And among one's possessions are women and children. And women become also a kind of commodity in this society, particularly among the Pashtuns, who have their own old code of conduct, the Pashtunwali. And in that code, the justice system actually sounds pretty good, because it's a kind of system that's meant to make amends when an injury has been done. Rather than necessarily punish the other guy, you try to make things right with him and his family. But in practice, what that means is that if you've murdered someone in your neighbor's family, you make it up to them by giving them some girls from your own family, who then become the wives, so-called. Some of us might call it sexual slavery, or household slaves of the other family.
Of the family that already may have reason to hate them because they were wronged.
That's quite correct. So girls are traded back and forth that way. Girls are also sold into marriage. A girl is an important commodity to bring some money into the family. And because each family has an interest in selling off their daughters before the daughters can get into trouble, girls typically are sold off very young, sometimes 7, 8, 9. They are sold as brides. And that has always gone on and still goes on. I just came back from Afghanistan, and during this trip I had the opportunity to visit villages in the remote mountains in Wardak province in the company of a woman doctor who has recently been elected to parliament. And she kept telling me that the women she visits in these villages do not think of themselves as human beings. They really think of themselves as a different species because of the way they're treated. Men are the humans. Then next in importance are the farm animals. And after that come the women. In a certain sense, the children even have priority over the woman because the boys will grow up to be of value to the family, and the girls have a certain value as potential commodities for sale. And I could see that when I went to the villages
How
and met
the
women. Just in the way they conduct themselves. There's a certain furtiveness, a certain reluctance to occupy space, a certain reluctance when they came to meet with the doctor, an enormous deference, as though she, as an educated woman coming from the town, was of a different species from them. They don't identify her as a woman. She is the doctor. And they are these pieces of property who have no rights, who never make a decision on anything. And to my way of thinking, the most important consideration is that they never have a choice. I wouldn't insist that all of these women are totally miserable and unhappy in their marriages or their families. I'm sure that many of them derive some satisfaction, some of them great satisfaction, from that life. But to me, the significant thing is that it's nothing they were ever able to choose.
You yourself have experienced or did experience abuse when you were growing up, and you wrote a book called Women Who Kill. And you make a connection in the book between the abuse that Afghan women that you've just so eloquently described experience every day. You quote one woman who's in Afghanistan who says that, you know, it's a society of mothers who are rape survivors, rape victims.
Yes.
So talk a little bit about the impact of that abuse. I mean, women do not stand alone. They are part of a network. What happens when women are treated this way in the society?
I think the most conspicuous characteristic, and this has been noted by many Afghans of the diaspora who have returned to their country from Europe or the United States, you observe a lack of empathy, an inability to empathize with the pain of other people because they have been so dehumanized themselves, and they do not think of other women as humans in some way. And one can see this. I spent a lot of time working with women in the hospitals and in the prisons, and you see that even women who have careers as caregivers, women doctors, have no basic empathy or sympathy with the very women they're treating. Not in every case, of course, but this is commonly observed. How would they learn it? You know, many of these girls who are married so young, their first experience of marriage is to be taken from their mother's household as young girls and raped by some man who is now their husband. It's not uncommon for young girls to die as a consequence of this. Many come to the hospital the next day for treatment to get themselves stitched back up again and repaired. So this is their first experience of marriage. Then very soon they're pregnant. You can go to the hospitals in Kabul and find 11, 12-year-old girls who've just had cesarean sections. And what the doctors themselves observe about these girls and think it a little odd is that they don't seem to identify with their own babies. One doctor described it to me as saying, it's as though nothing has happened to them.
Ann Jones investigated the conditions at the women's prison in Kabul. She brought a translator, an educated middle-class Afghani woman. The visit not only profoundly affected Ann Jones, it also affected her translator. You know, you talk at one moment of your translator. You went into the prison and you had a translator who had one attitude going in and another attitude leaving. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Well, this is another consequence of the Afghan moral system, because, of course, under patriarchy, no matter where it occurs, we have a very clear definition of good women and bad women, policing the sexuality of women. And nobody polices women's sexuality any more determinedly than women themselves. And so it's very difficult to get women who should take an interest in the sufferings of other women to do so if those women are defined as bad. And consequently, we couldn't get women lawyers to go to the prisons to help the prisoners because they considered women who had been sent to prison, by definition, bad women that they couldn't associate with. But I persuaded a translator, one of my English students, to go along with me. And the experience for her of having to translate the stories of bad women to me made her, of course, understand the stories of those so-called bad women. And she began to see them in a completely different light, had a complete change of heart. But the way the society is structured, few Afghan women have an opportunity to do that. They don't have the opportunity to meet women and talk to women who have already been defined as bad and off limits.
And women who often were raped and then were arrested because they were raped and therefore seen as bad.
Yes, most of the women, I should say, who wind up in prison are there because of crimes that we would not consider crimes or crimes against themselves. There are women who ran away from home to escape abuse or to escape forced marriage, or being forced into prostitution by their husbands. There are women accused of crimes of zina, that is, sex outside of marriage. And a woman who leaves her father's home leaves herself automatically open to the charge of being guilty of zina. And a woman who is raped is guilty of zina, adultery, even though, of course,
she had no power to control that.
Yeah, it wasn't actually something she chose. But if you point that out to an Afghan judge or lawyer, they'll say, but she had sex.
The book is Winter in Kabul, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan. You can find a link to Ann Jones's most recent article in The Nation magazine about Afghani women at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. You can listen to all our shows, plus find out much more about our guests and their books at writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.